Wilson.
We will start the implementation activity session with agenda papers 12A to 12C. This set of papers aims to help you decide on the direction of the project related to the proposed amendment to IS 16, PP&E proceeds before intended use. We previously provided you with a summary of feedback on the ED and said we would undertake follow-up research. Today we come back to you with agenda paper 12B, which provides our analysis of feedback, and with agenda paper 12C, which set out the possible direction of the project and our recommendation. Paper 12C asks you to decide on the direction of this project. I will now move on to agenda paper 12B and will provide you with a view of the salient aspect of our feedback analysis. Overall, many respondents either disagreed with or expressed concern about the proposed amendments. The first area of comments relates to the recognition in profit or loss of the sales proceeds and their related production costs. This is explained in paragraph 18 to 36. Some respondents viewed the proposed amendment as an improvement to financial reporting, whilst some other questioned the usefulness of information that would result therefrom. This is because such proceeds have limited predictive value. In our view, the proposed amendments are consistent with the principles set out in the conceptual framework and would thus provide useful information. However, we think some presentation and disclosure requirements could enhance the proposed amendments. The next area of comments relates to cost allocation. Many respondents said the requirement to separately identify costs related to items sold would present practical challenges and might result in diversity in the reporting of costs. We discussed this point in paragraph 37 to 56 of the paper. We are not convinced that the proposed amendments would create any significant new practical challenge from a cost accounting perspective. However, we think it may be helpful to possibly consider developing requirements or principle on cost allocation. Finally, a number of respondents suggested the board address the broader matter of identifying what an item of PP&E is available for use. This is explained in paragraphs 57 to 72. In our view, paragraph DC20 of the ED includes helpful indicators on this point, but there was almost no feedback on those indicators. We note that the board also considered clarifying when an item of PP&E is available for use before publishing the ED and decided not to follow that approach. We think the respondents have not identified any new information that would change the board's decision not to undertake standard setting on this broader matter. The feedback also included other areas of comments that we summarized and analyzed in paragraph 73 to 97 of the paper. I will now pause here and ask whether you have any questions or comments on our feedback summary and analysis as set out in this paper.
Very interesting material there. Sell something that it's not necessarily revenue or income. Pretty astounding. Mary.
Just two comments on the feedback you had. One is on material covered on page 6 with the feedback you had from investors. And they're talking about the importance of the computation of unit cash costs. If I think about how much do I care about trying to maintain the integrity of the unit cash cost calculation, my first instinct is not very much, because if I think about extractive industries and, for example, significant decommissioning costs that will come, they would not be a cash cost. And so if somebody says, well, I'm using a metric like this, they know what they're doing, but I think there's such significant non-cash costs that it doesn't drive me to say I have to restrain what we think is the right accounting in order to facilitate use of this, because I think that a number like unit cash cost ignores costs that I expect to be very important for the current period activities. So that's one. And the second is on, I think it's page 10, and some of the discussion about the complexity of the allocation because areas of a mine may be at different stages of development or production, presumably they're going to have to track it by the different areas of a mine for when they are actually doing production, because if you have Area A in production and Area B in development, if you're producing from Area A, you have to do this allocation of cost to be able to report your production from A. So I think that this is a, you know, an it is not an incremental cost of what we are proposing doing. It is a cost that they are going to have to incur anyway in terms of the accounting by section of the mine. So it doesn't strike me as a factor to be considered in terms of which approach we're taking. I don't, you know, I don't think it's determinative, but in terms of reciting the information that you had, I question how compelling that is as a concern about cost.
Yeah, and I think when we spoke to the mining companies, Mary, they did acknowledge they were already doing a series of complex cost allocations, but indicated that this would add an additional layer of complexity.
I'm not questioning that, but I think the basic allocation that you're describing on page 10 is one that they have to do anyway. And so they'd have to be doing it on an ongoing basis, not only at some later point, and we're accelerating it or making them do it twice.
Daryl.
I just want to confirm at this stage, before we get into the next paper, that the comments that were made by the mining entities here was in anticipation of how this would affect their accounting now with existing IFRS 6 in place, and not how they thought it might affect their accounting if IFRS 6 were put in. In other words, this relates to their assets that are outside the scope of the existing IFRS 6 at this point.
Yes, that's correct, yes.
Doc.
Thank you. I just want to know the benefit and or disadvantage. Lots of people are arguing about the cost allocation. So cost allocation could be much more complicated. But as you pointed out, IS2 paragraph 14 provides the good guidance about the byproducts or some joint products. Yeah. And if we follow such guidance, cost allocation wouldn't be too difficult. So if we could develop some guidance developed on the joint products or byproducts, then we can provide some good guidance for cost allocation. Then, having said that, on the other hand, what is the benefit of this proposal is all about? My question is there any urgent need for the users group to know the, you know, to avoid diversification? If that need is significant, then we can compare the benefit may exceed the you know, new concern about cost allocation. We can go ahead with original proposal. But if the user's needs is not very much urgent, then we can wait for another research project of you know, mining industry. So that is the information I would like to know. So Nick raised the card.
I think he's looking at you, Nick.
Do you want to answer, to respond to that? I think this, from what I understand, this goes beyond just extractive industries. It affects other industries as well. There are a number of concerns raised about the potential volatility the proposed changes would create, but that's just in that startup period. And for me, what's particularly invidious is that you are, because you're reducing your capital cost, that you're actually reducing your depreciation and increasing your profitability for the whole life of the project.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what happened in that startup period will be forgotten, and how you did that. But you'll get this benefit, which appears to be, will then have a multiple attached to it. And it feels, so I think there is benefit there. It's hard to quantify the exact scale of the issue, but it does concern me in that respect.
Okay.
Anne? My point was somewhat similar to what Nick is raising. When you look at this, it seems to be better accounting over in the income statement and better accounting in the balance sheet, but we have this feedback that focuses in all the time on the problems of cost allocation and various other problems that relate to income statement items. So did we get any support in the feedback for the fact that the asset would be better measured under the proposals?
Not really.
Not really. Many respondents outlined the drawbacks of the proposed amendment, but the potential benefits, unfortunately, there was not much focus on that. And while those benefits were also highlighted, some of those benefits were highlighted in the basis for conclusion of the ED, but unfortunately, we didn't receive much comment on that part of the project. So that's why we thought necessary to remind them in the other agenda paper.
Yeah, the focus was very, very much on the income statement.
It doesn't remain funny account.
If it's helpful, I know, Tack, just to respond to your comment about, you know, thinking about what's already in IS2, yeah. By the way, about cost allocation when you've got joint products going on. And only to say I agree with you, I think that is there in IS2. And interestingly, there is IFRIC 20 as well.
Yeah.
You may have been an interpretation committee member when it was developed. And that, by the way, again, was specifically developed to address how do you allocate costs if there's two things happening. If you're potentially increasing the value of a PP&E item at the same time as producing inventory. And what that interpretation did, it lifted the words in IS2 that tells you how you go about allocating cost, and it sort of expanded it a bit. So what you were saying is something I think that has been done before in IFRIC 20.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Go on,
So, agenda paper 12C. So this paper explores the possible ways forward, and we are asking you two questions. So in this paper, we explain that many of the concerns about the proposed amendments relates to the proposed change to measurement requirement in IAS 16 that is requiring an entity to recognize the sales proceeds and the related cost in profit or loss. In paragraph 6 to 10, we discuss the expected benefits of the proposed amendments. Paragraph 11 to 40 details stakeholders' main concerns, most of which relate to the cost of the proposed amendments. Those paragraphs also identified the board's possible responses to those concerns and thus the possible ways of reducing the cost of standard setting. We have identified three possible approaches to move forward with the project. The modified ED approach, described in paragraph 44 to 53 of the paper, would consist in proceeding with the proposed changes to the measurement requirement in IS 16, but also considering developing principle or requirements on cost allocation, as well as presentation and disclosure requirements. This approach would address some of the concerns about cost allocation and the limited predicted value of the sales proceeds. Most members of the interpretations committee supported that approach. We discussed the testing and disclosure approach in paragraph 54 to 62. Applying this approach, the board would not change the measurement requirement in IS 16 and would instead require disclosure of the amount of proceeds credited against the cost of an item of PP&E. The board would also proceed with the proposed definition of testing activities included in the ED, which, in our view, is helpful to assess when an item of PP&E is available for use. Most members of ASAF supported that approach. We discussed the third and last approach in paragraph 63 to 68. Applying this approach, the board would proceed with none of the proposed amendments included in the ED. Paragraph 75 to 81 explain why, on balance, we recommend the board proceed with a disclosure-focused approach, that is, the testing and disclosure approach. The first question for you is on page 20 of the paper. I will pause here and ask whether you agree with our recommendation not to proceed with the proposed amendments as exposed in the ED, and instead proceed with the testing and disclosure approach.
Gary.
Before I respond to question one, can I just ask you some questions on paragraphs 26 and 27? In paragraph 26, and you said this several times in paper 12B, it says, mm-hmm. have limited predictive value, and I'm inclined to agree with that. But you go down to paragraph 27, but we think it has confirmatory value. Confirming what? you don't develop that. I'm not sure it confirms anything, other than you can sell some residual indebtedness, you know, coming out of the mine for some amount of money.
Yeah.
So what does it confirm?
It was confirming that a sale has occurred, so providing evidence to users in the income statement that a sale has occurred.
Okay. But it's not confirming the validity of the mining operation is likely to be successful, just confirming you got some cash inflow.
Yes.
Which you would presumably see in the statement of cash flows.
You probably wouldn't, because if it was booked against the cost of the PP&E, I'd assume people would net it against the cash investment.
It's still cash. You know,
it would net it against the investment in PP&E.
Mm-hmm. But you still got to account for cash on hand, you know, with the beginning cash and ending cash. It does come in someplace. Or your roll forward or reconciliation of beginning ending balances of PP&E. I mean, it doesn't just go away. It's got to be there someplace. Even if you net it, you know, it's still cash inflow. I agree, it might not be its own line in the cash flow statement, but it's still there somewhere, and it's certainly going to be affecting the ending balance. We didn't get particularly robust supportive feedback on this project. To be kind.
You did get a lot of feedback, though.
I didn't say you got a lot of robust supportive feedback. I didn't say you didn't get a lot of feedback. We didn't develop all that well, because I don't necessarily disagree with the recommendation, but I think you can make a case, is this even worth going forward? You know, I think we need to think hard about that, because I agree, I think this is heavily aimed at one industry, extractive, and perhaps even extractive, not all subsets of that. So you start wondering, is it just worth going forward? And it's one thing to require a disclosure of the revenue proceeds, you know, before it's declared operational. You know, maybe that's something, but, you know, we've not gone forward with projects that have had more, you know, value at the end.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, that those were the arguments we wanted to put forward to the board in terms of the disclosure focused ED. Like, it wasn't a clear cut conclusion in our mind. We received such a lot of feedback that the proposals as drafted didn't work, and you know, arguably not going forward is a possibility, and we did put that as approach three. And it really comes down to, you know, in our view, whether the merits of either proposal one or two exceed the cost of them, and it could be considered to be marginal by some.
As this went through the process some years ago, before yours and Sunstein, we struggled to get the exposure draft out. For the reasons discussed, you know, for the feedback. And I hate to see a lot of work just go to nothing. Mm-hmm. I would not say, we'll just toss it to the extractive indices project, because you might see something in 10 years, you know, on that. But it's a much bigger project than this. But honestly, I do have my doubts. Is this worth the effort of going forward? And we've killed stuff that have had more value.
Doc?
Thank you. Can I ask a question about the clarifying testing procedure? So you are going to clarify that the testing we mean is not financial performance, but physical performance, technical and physical performance. So, for example, you are refiner, and up until you can achieve 90% of refinement, if the management says, we don't think testing period has not finished, is it the financial performance or technical performance?
I think we did hear from some respondents that there could be a fine line between the two, between technical and financial. but you know, the view put forward in the ED and what we're proposing to retain in both approaches 1 and 2 is that it's not a financial assessment, it's a technical and physical assessment. So it's based on, say, achieving 90% of production capacity as opposed to a specific profitability target.
Right. So then suppose some company is using financial performance target, say, the profit of this one or sales of this amount, then if we clarify the meaning of testing period, then that company has to change their practice?
Yeah, that's true.
Right,
that's
okay. True. All right, okay. And because as Nick pointed out, this proposal do not only covers extractive industry, but also covers a lot of industry like refinery industry or possibly, I don't know whether pharmaceutical or not. Yeah. So, you know, to pull out this project is easy, but, you know, we have to know if we pull out this project, then what is the impact we may miss? I mean, because we are trying to do it because we want to improve the financial statement, which covers a variety of industry based on the principle.
Yeah.
But there are vocal industry saying that it is, you know, really difficult to do the cost allocation.
Yeah.
So then stopping it will mask, you know, lots of area which we could improve. Yeah. So that is the point I want to know. So thank you.
Just on the industry point, like we did try to acknowledge in the paper that whilst we received an overwhelming amount of feedback that this was a significant issue for the mining industry as a subset of the extractive industries, we do think the issue. It's not restricted to that industry. We just didn't get a lot of feedback and evidence. You know, people weren't saying much, but for extractives, I would say, Vansel, maybe 30 to 50% of the letters mentioned extractives. Either it was extractive issues responding or people saying you should refer this to restractives. But, you know, in our mind, though, the way we've tried to position that in a paper is a secondary issue. We'd like first the board to say, how would you like us to proceed with this project? And then depending on that, if anything's left over, does it make sense for the board to consider including this within the scope of the extractors project? But we do recognise that's a separate question and there's significant limitations for that. And it isn't, in my mind, and based on the evidence received, just extractives and just mining. But it is, there's a lot of mining companies that are impacted by this.
Mr.
Well, I mean, I'm going to respond to your question instead of...
Françoise, may I just add one additional comfort for the around definition of testing activities. This definition is not, well, does not specifically inter-address the matter of proceeds before intended use, but is also about response to the concerns that were expressed by many stakeholders around how an entity assess when an asset is available for use, and this is an assessment that many entities do in practice, and this clarification might help those entities improving this assessment, and accordingly we think that this definition might have an impact that would flow beyond the extractive industry.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's right. Sorry.
Okay. So I would like to support the staff recommendation of going for your testing and disclosure approach. I think it's and in fact I've been impressed by the way the discussion is very balanced. So it's so balanced that I've been convinced that you haven't overseen any possible benefit to doing otherwise. So I think it's the approach that reaches the a satisfactory cost-benefit level, in my view, because we have all industries, in fact, that are possibly affected by that, with, in fact, the extractive industries being more particularly where, in fact, both benefits and difficulties eventually are material. And for the all other industries, it seems to be much less present, but much less prevalent. So it would be, in my view, a lot of possible costs just implementing and for not necessarily a big benefit. And I also appreciate the fact that improving the disclosures keep us in the possibility of monitoring those developments. So I really support this recommendation on the basis of your analysis.
Sue?
I agree exactly with what Françoise just said for the same reasons that she gave. Just a couple of observations on some of the stakeholder comments that were raised, so not your reactions to them, but the comments raised, because I think there's a few things in here that, certainly as I read the paper, they jarred a bit, and they're things that I want to watch for going forward. Firstly, I think it's a bit of an unusual argument to support that suggests that something shouldn't go to profit or loss simply on the basis that it's effectively non-recurring. Certainly, I think that there may be a case for why you'd want separate, you know, information provided about it because of that nature, but I don't think we should start entertaining the idea, and I'm not suggesting the staff are, but start entertaining the idea that because something's non-recurring that that's a reason for it not to go to P&L, which is, I think, behind some of these comments. The other one that worries me a bit that's creeping into stakeholder comments when they're talking to us is when they don't agree with what we're doing, this reaction of telling us that if you do that, we're going to provide non-GAAP information. And, you know, there's a place for non-GAAP information and there's different perspectives and that's fine, and we're trying to address that in other projects, but I don't think that we should be sort of thinking, oh, my God, we shouldn't make decisions because they're going to come up with non-GAAP information in response, and I think that's just something we need to watch for. But I agree with your recommendation, and I like Françoise, I think it's also a very useful way to gather some more information because it's so lacking in visibility at the moment.
Nick?
Thank you. So I have a number of concerns here. So first, the extensive use of the testing activities expedient seems to be very wide-scale use of this, and it feels like it's really being stretched as a loophole. Clearly, sales proceeds meet the conceptual framework definition of revenue. I don't think there's any dispute over that. I kind of left concerned about the strength of opposition that's been expressed through the feedback, I have to say. But the disclosure approach really doesn't work for me, because it'll tell me in the first year what the sales proceeds number is. But actually, because the impact is so, it lasts for a number of years, I'll lose that information effectively. I know it'll be there if I have to go back through the accounts to find it. But 5 years' time, it won't be in the reported accounts then. But I'll have this nicely depressed capital cost, give me a higher return on capital than perhaps is economically realistic. So for me, I can't support the staff recommendation. I'd be more in the modified ED camp, I have to say. I'm also concerned about the time it will take to collect the information going down the disclosure route and then going potentially into the extractive industries project. This pushes this out for years and years and years. So I find myself, as say, in the modified ED camp.
Yeah, when I read these papers, I thought, how can this possibly be material? Well, apparently it's big numbers. And if it's big numbers, then there is also a lot of possibility for abuse of these proceeds. It's just the strength of the resistance might indicate that it's a very successful loophole. I don't feel comfortable. Amaro?
Thanks, Hans. I'll be short. Thanks, Nick, for his concerns expressed. I do very much share Nick's concern. And I think I share Taka's discomfort in not going ahead with our original proposal. I think it provides better accounting. It's aligned with our conceptual framework. And I sincerely think, I understand, I'm sympathetic to one particular industry that reacted strongly to the proposal, but this is not only affecting one industry. Mm. So I think this is completely significant inappropriate for us to defer to a particular project that is going to discuss extractive industry. This applies to any type of business. So consider that I can't support staff's proposal on this. So if I have to stay with the options that you give me here, I would go for the modified ED, although I have concerns in the modified ED in terms of scope, because then you are bringing here like requirements of principal cost allocation. Apparently this was not the original scope of the project. I don't know how much it would take. And the clarification of meaning of testing. I guess industries that do buy a particular item of PPE, they have a notion of what is testing for them. But I agree with Nick. I think that this concept, it's apparently being stretched very much by some industries. So I would go for the modified ED.
And just to clarify, like Amaro and Nick, independent of the extractives recommendation, you would still go with modified ED, because we try to table that, hopefully successfully, as a completely separate question.
I would never do that at the ISB level, never.
Defer to another project?
Defer to a project to treat a different industry. Yeah. I'm totally against it.
Okay, thank you.
Genjao.
Thank you, Hans. I also have some concerns about the testing and the disclosure approach. But I also don't want to go to the modified approach, modified exposure draft approach. I think the issue come out, and the key issue is actually how to define available for sale, how to determine it. If we cannot clarify what's the meaning of available for sale, I think the issue still will be there. So I would like to take available for sale, determination of available sale plus disclosure approach. A couple of reasons. First, if we go to testing approach, we still need to clarify what's the meaning of testing activities. We are going to focus on technical, physical performance, something like that. I think we are not specialized in this area. We're specialized in financing and accounting area. And secondly, we still need to determine what's the end of testing activity, testing period. Whether the testing period will be ahead of available for sale, or whether the testing period could be last longer after available for sale, those aspects. Available for use. It is not clear. So we still cannot avoid, even we are going to testing approach, we still cannot avoid when they will be stopped. What's the end of the testing period? When they should be, those procedures should not deducted from the PPE, should go to P&L. So we still cannot avoid to determine what's the meaning of available for use. Secondly, we under current IFI standard, we don't have some gray area, we silent on this area, but we can find some standard whether they have similar, you know, requirements, similar requirement there. So I think IS 23 is a good example for us to make reference that. I think in substance, the issue exactly the same as the borrowing cost issue. When they should be stopped, this is the capitalized of those borrowing costs. We should look at those PPE, whether they meet the criteria of available for use. So I think the requirement of IS 23 could give us a very good indicator, very good example to resolve this issue. The issue is the same. Yeah, one is simply because the cost should be added to the PPE, or whether the revenue the company generated should be deducted from PPE. But both of these are focused on what's the time point. that time point should be available for use. So this second point. Third point, based on the paper 12B, we got a lot of feedback. I think many stakeholders, even we seek the input from ASAP member, something, many of stakeholders mentioned we should address this issue, available for use, and then resolve the issue substantially. Finally, how to resolve this issue? I think the paragraph BC20 of the exposure draft, we actually proposed some indicators. And it seemed that there are no comments with regard to those indicators. I think one of the reasons, maybe people just happy with it, they did not comment that. Another reason, because we didn't ask those questions related to those indicators. And they are included in the BC of the exposure draft. But when I look at those indicators, I think it provided more useful, direction, better than try to define what's the meaning of testing activities. And it will be directly helpful for us to resolve the issue where we would like to address. So this. So finally, in summary, I would like to approach that available for sale plus disclosure, or available for use plus disclosure approach. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And you're right. Like, we did hear a lot of comments from stakeholders that the board could have perhaps addressed available for use, and those stakeholders were concerned that, the issue that we're dealing with, the amount of revenue that we're dealing with, because they thought the available for use date was too far away, should have been earlier on. So the revenue or the income, whatever it may be, was a lot bigger than the actual number should be. So they thought that we should address both issues together, which sounds to be your recommendation. And some of what you said, I think, is not dissimilar to the dissenting opinion to the ED. Why we didn't include that as a recommendation was because we think, perhaps consistent with the board's original conclusion on ED, that this would require more resources to develop that. We could consider, though, the indicators that were in BC20, as you pointed out. Unfortunately, not a lot of people did comment on whether those would be useful to include in modifications to IS16. But that may be to your point, because we didn't actually ask them a specific question on that.
Martin? Can I just follow up on that, if it's helpful, by the way, Jen Chai as well. But because obviously the reason that was all spelled out on the basis was because it's not because the board or the committee didn't think about this before we developed the ED. It was very much a central part of the considerations. And then the board set out, both the thinking and BC20, if we were going to do this, how might we do it, as well as spelling out the reasons why that wasn't the proposal put in the ED. And the first thing to say, by the way, is at least as staff, there's a lesson from this to me in terms of how we ask the questions, because, with hindsight, I wish we'd asked a direct question on that. In saying that, though, whilst, a lot of people in comment letters said, the underlying problem is available for you, you should address it. They didn't comment on the basis, and even a lot of the time that the staff have been doing over the last months is trying to follow up with those people, ask people directly, if you think the board should address available for use, how do you think they should do it? What do you think about the suggestions in the basis? And it's been very difficult to get any real response back for people to actually say, great, we love that. And maybe because of just the fact we've directly tried to get feedback on that and really have found it quite difficult, I suppose I just fear if we suddenly decided to think that's the direction to go and then we'd have to expose something else, that at that point we'd then just get a raft of other reasons why not to go that route. And in fact, some of the concerns, and I heard you mention, Françoise, is in fact that would be, first of all, a much bigger project, but all of the concerns about this affecting people who it doesn't really matter for would become a much bigger deal then, I think. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at available for use, it affects everybody that's got PP&E. the way we've done the ED actually should be a way of trying to target this where there's been that identified problem, because it only should be targeting and it should only affect and therefore, you know, in, sort of as a consequence, incur any cost for those people who have any significant amounts of these seals before, you know, you hit that point of available for use and starting to depreciate. So I suppose I was just going to say, I don't know whether the feedback sent you in a different direction, but at least I would, you know, if we hadn't done all we'd done, I'd think, great, let's do that. It's just based on where we are today. I just don't see a route that would say that would be a more successful route and a more acceptable route than necessarily the one that we proposed or the modified ED route.
Can I ask everybody to be succinct? We still have a lot of speakers. Beryl?
So I'm support the others who have concluded that the modified ED approach is the more reasonable approach to follow with this. I think for me, the importance is this question that I asked earlier about the fact that what we're dealing with here is not the assets that we have, that the board has historically concluded are extractive in nature and therefore under IFRS 6, but rather those assets that the board has previously concluded are similar to other fixed assets in other industries. And I think what we are talking, the concern that I would have here is if this is a problem that is clearly more apparent in this industry, but is equally relevant to all other industries that have these fixed assets and have this type of issue, then all we're doing is we're potentially thinking about isolating one industry for no other reason than it might have bigger assets or slightly longer duration assets than others. And it means that we're almost suggesting in some of the thinking and paragraph 74, thinking about the idea of creating special accounting for this industry. My concern here would be that I think this is a problem that we've identified across a broad range. It is a diversity problem, and I think that we should be trying to see if we can resolve it. And I think we've got feedback in that space. And again, I have some concerns, and I'll talk about it when we get to question two.
Martin.
Now, if I remember correctly, I think the problem which I saw when we developed that was, okay, we are not able to give more guidance when is the point when the product or the equipment is ready for use, because that is more technical, different, and we are not expert. And therefore we said, okay, why don't we develop this revenue approach, which I think is easier, and I think we should continue with that, maybe modify that, because I think disclosure will not solve the problem. And I was also not convinced by many of the arguments, because people say, okay, then we have revenue without the cost. Yeah, maybe, but currently they have maybe so much revenue netted against the cost that they have a period then after that, which they have revenues and no cost. I think that was a problem identified originally. Yes. And therefore, I think we should, and that is, I think, conceptually, I think what we decided already, still the right way, because, and these arguments provided, I was really not convinced by them.
Tom?
A couple of general comments, and then one if we do go this route. I think, if I pick up what Jin Chao said, is there are real concerns. It makes a lot of sense that if, on the revenue side, it sounds like it ought to go into the profit and loss. The problems arise in that we don't define well available for use, and we don't have good ideas about how to allocate costs. And so that's what we heard back, is going with what we did go. They people came back and said, you haven't done these two things well enough, I don't think. And I think that that's okay. And when I look at the ED, am I confident that if we go with the modified ED that we will pick up those two problems and solve them? I think developing how an entity determines the production cost is going to be a huge exercise. And so I'm really worried about what we're going to take on. So I was inclined to go with the recommendation about testing and disclosure, because I don't know that we have, I don't know what the bang for the buck would be given the costs of doing a modified ED. If we do go to the testing and disclosure, I did have one small comment, and it just goes, so currently, if you go to sales before available for use, some people are deducting all of them, and some people are deducting some of them. And I think one of the proposals is that they disclose the amount that's deducted from property, plant, and equipment. If we're going to learn about this, it would be good to know how much sales are attached to this pre-available for use in their entirety, where they end up on the profit and loss or whether they end up deducted. And so I would just, you could show them the two elements, but I'd like that disclosure to pick up all of it so that when you look across entities, you would know how much was sold before available for use. The nice thing about disclosure is you don't have to go through this big question about how do you allocate all the costs, which I actually think is going to be a really difficult problem.
Mary?
I do not support the staff recommendation. I think instead we should proceed with a modified version of the ED. However, I think it should be more significantly modified or modified in a different way than the staff suggested. And I worry a bit that we are maybe not seeing the forest for the trees in terms of this issue, because like Hans, the strength and this is the end of the Western civilization as we know it, kind of tone of the comment letters, says to me this is a much bigger problem than it should be. And that makes me want to do something more rather than less. And let me just come back to IS-16. What we're talking about is not sales before it's available for use, because paragraph 20 of IS-16 says cost does not, the following costs are not included in the carrying amount of an item of PP&E, and that is costs incurred while it's capable but has yet to be brought into use or is operated at less than full capacity. So that says that is not a cost to capitalize. Okay. And the other thing we have is when it is talking about, it's remembering, it's saying capitalize the cost of testing. You know, what the standard says now is capitalize the cost of testing, but by the way, testing, only the costs of testing are netted down for any sales proceeds. But what it's clear that the standard, and sorry, I'm getting on a soapbox, but it's clear to me that the standard expected these to be trivial amounts, because they're saying the net proceeds from selling any items produced while bringing the asset to the location and condition. And the example is such as samples produced when testing equipment. This should not be a number that is big enough to warrant anybody writing a comment letter, opposing these. So if people are reacting this strongly, I think there's a much bigger problem, and we're sanctioning it. And so I just come back to saying, I think we have to do A, and I think some of the considerations that people raised about the complexity of cost allocation suggest that there's a much bigger volume being offset against the cost. I think when I step back and think about what the standard is saying, that you capitalize the cost of testing, the activity that should be conducting is testing. And so, while I think we were thinking about how much the sales proceeds might be kind of an anticipation of their what will ultimately be their ordinary activities, I think that I think we should actually modify it and say, it's the sales proceeds from testing activities. Testing activities are not the normal activities of the entity. If you have any sales proceeds from a byproduct, and I'm not using your refinement, that is a byproduct of your testing activities, then it should not be in revenue, it should be in a separate line item, and either have no cost associated with it, because presumably the costs that you are incurring are the costs of conducting your testing activities, and you should apply the normal requirements for testing activities, and just, and then the separate, the exclusion from revenue with disclosure of the amount of the sales proceeds, if material, would tell, wouldn't distort the ongoing trends, wouldn't distort the margins, and it wouldn't screw up the carrying value of PP&E. So I say go with a modified version of the ED, but be clear that it's out of revenue, and in response to how big an issue this cost allocation would be, I think determine an accounting policy that, you say what the net proceeds from selling are, but we presume that the activity you're conducting is testing, because that's the only proceeds that are legit, that are addressed here, and account for the cost of testing as the standard requires, and then disclose what you do to determine what, if anything, is netted. but it's got to be outside of revenue.
Brilliant.
And any other proceeds, because that was the original question, was what do we do with proceeds before available for use, and should an entity distinguish between those that are generated from testing and those that are generated not from testing? So would your...
The standard tells us that it's the only comment about netting is about proceeds from sales of byproducts of testing. It says clearly that if you have costs, but presumably that also applies to sales. Sorry, it's like I'm yelling at you and I'm not. It's just, it's paragraph 20 says the fact that you're not operating at capacity. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just to clarify, though, is your recommendation just for sales proceeds from testing? Because the board did discuss that previously and chose deliberately, you know, not to distinguish between those proceeds generated from testing and those from other activities before available for use.
Well, I think that the piece that I want to pick up from your approach B is the comment about clarifying that testing is an operational and technical activity and not hitting of financial targets, because I think financial targets is when you get into paragraph 20. So I think I would keep it, and yes, I probably would go back and revisit that. Maybe the staff will come back with a wider recommendation for a wider relief. That goes to before use rather than just testing. Okay. But if we're trying to remember what we set out to do, it was a narrow scope amendment to address diversity in practice. And if the diversity is greater than we anticipated because people have been reading this too broadly, let's just go back to remind people what the words say and then address the lack of clarity with the words.
I think if I understand you, Mary, are you saying we should remember to focus on the sales from testing, because actually you think reading the words in IS 16, that's the only thing that IS 16 would have ever contemplated being kind of credit against the cost.
Yes.
If there's any other sales, and you shouldn't even have thought that you could credit them in the P&L.
Right.
You should already be in.
That's correct. And I am, however, supporting what we had in the ED and what is in the staff's first approach of changing IS 16 to say enough with the credit and proceeds business.
Okay, Chengwu.
Okay. I'm also in the camp of the modified ED, but one question on the two responses from our interpretation committee and ASAP. They have the the committee would like to have their modified ED. However, ASAP members would like to have this kind of a testing and disclosure. Why these two groups have a different advice to us? No, it's very strange,
good
you
question.
Know? Yeah, good question. If you see that panel A4, most committee members would like to have an approach too. That's a modified ED. And they think, you know, the cost allocation principles, you know, everything is feasible. They are suggesting that they are all professionals, right? But in the case of ASAP, if you see the B3, many ASAP members support the approach 3. That's a testing and a kind of additional disclosure. They are basically national standard setters. So these two groups have very different views.
I think, Chengwu, it's probably fair to say that obviously reflecting the mixture in the overall feedback reflects that obviously as well, both discussions, it wasn't, for example, that everybody at the Interpretations Committee said one thing and everybody at ASAP said another. So there was obviously still some mixture in the feedback. But there was that divide that said, you know, more of the commentary and more of the advice from the Interpretations Committee was to go ahead with potentially some modifications, whereas more of the advice from ASAP was maybe just disclosure.
Something else that concerns me is the comment on page 3 in item 9 that says that this expedient in relation to IS 16 has been applied into other standards and used in a way that was never intended. So for me, that's another factor that supports modified ED approach.
Gary.
Despite my reservations about the project, actually would say I think the staff had the right technical answers, that the proceeds are in fact revenue and that the testing phases ends when you hit the engineering you know, objectives and so on. Before I give a few comments, just a couple comments, just a few questions. The comment letters that we received, were most of them from the extractive industries? Do we get other commercial, industrial, manufacturing? What's the character of the, there's a reason why I'm asking the question.
We received many comment letters from standard setters, audit firms. So from preparers, we received comment letters from organization of preparers and individual mining industries wrote comment letters to us and explaining they disagreed with the proposed amendment. But the feedback is not composed of 90% of companies coming from the extractive industry. There is much more diversity. So many in the mining company opposed the proposed amendment, but there was significant part of the comment letters, but definitely not the majority. Not the majority. Many comment letters coming from standard setters.
Here's the concern I was raising. We're going to redefine or propose to define when does testing end and operations begin. If we didn't have, if the feedback we got was substantially in the industry, as opposed to a more broader-based constituency, you wonder, do we have another problem, you know, out there? If you went out for something that's really, most of the input came from mining and extractive, now you're trying to apply this definition, as we said earlier, it really applies to everybody. So I think the answer to the question was not predominantly mining, even though there's a fair amount in it.
It wasn't predominantly mining, and I would say, like, Vanson, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I would say those who commented on mining expressed the most concerns about cost allocation. Those that were, say, not specifically focused on mining might have expressed concerns about cost allocation, but then across the board, quite a lot of them expressed concerns about available for use. So I would say that was less extractive focus. That was some of the firms, the standard setters expressed concerns there.
Yeah. I got half a dozen more things I want to quickly ask. I would say for major companies, I would think understanding their costs, actually, they're probably pretty good at it if you're reasonably well managed. Will be not thinking of it the way we think of it. They're going to be thinking, you know, fixed, variable, discretionary, non-discretionary, cash, non-cash. But big companies, understanding your cost is a very big part of finance operations, much more so than external reporting or something like that. So I suspect they well understand it. Now, I don't know about you refer to them as junior miners, you know, in here when you get less sophistication and they're smaller and so on. But on the junior miner sense, do we have a sense how many of them would be subject to full standards versus the SME standard? You know, I'm wondering, if they're junior and they're small, they're privately owned, or it's all venture capital money or something, they might even might not even be subject to this.
Yeah, there's lots listed because a lot of Australia, they're all on IFRS and they're junior. And I don't know about Canada.
That's really Venture Exchange in Canada's full of extractive.
So okay, so there's enough listed. Yeah. So it's okay. That's actually a good answer. Yeah.
It's like the lottery, you buy a share and it might pan out or not.
Yeah. Is there a sense that, to the extent that revenue is netted today against the cost of PPE, and that actually it's an error in accounting, or is it just, do you think it fits neatly that it's a discretionary choice inside 16 or elsewhere?
For testing activities, it's a requirement.
I'm sorry?
For the testing activities, it's a requirement.
Okay,
activities, the standard is silent. And some people think that this bit can be analogized to any proceeds before intended use, but for time being,
it's a requirement. This would be a change in, from net to gross and immediate recognition in P&L versus many years through depreciation. A lot of this issues in this project doesn't come from revenue, it comes from cost and the cost allocations. And originally, we did start off with, should we have revenue being gross versus net? That's just the essence of where this started 4 or 5 years ago. Has there been any thought about just having them gross up revenue, just ignore costs, you know? And sort of anathema in this, in this building, but
that's what I was suggesting.
Yeah, I don't think we're alone on that. Just revenue should be booked as revenue. It's a conceptual framework. Yeah. Just don't worry about the cost.
I think the staff would agree with that. And we do think revenue is revenue, income is income. we didn't explore an approach where you did ignore the costs in part. And we know the issue is significant for the junior mining entities. They don't have a whole lot in their income statement. They've got a ton of debt on the balance sheet. They've got a going concern note. It would certainly require some kind of market education if the proposals were to go ahead with just income only. Not to say that that couldn't be done, maybe that is a way forward, but just to ensure that investors do understand that this is just a pre...
But the point is the difficulties and subjectivities of cost allocation go away, which is where much of the resistance came from. In any event, actually, I changed my mind. I've come around to a modified ED.
Okay.
Is I'm not necessarily sure the modified ED you're articulated here.
Yeah.
But I don't think the test and disclosure approach does it.
And it sounds like, you know, if it is modified ED, it might require some more exploration with the board members as to what that modification is.
I still have doubts as to some direction.
Yeah.
Françoise. And then let's vote.
Well, I mean, since it seems that the majority is going for the modified ED, if that materializes, I would want to really support what Mary said. Because one of my opposition to what was proposed, in fact implied in the largely in the basis for conclusions to in the ED, was the fact that we would force this accounting into revenue and that we would force the cost in cost of sales, as if in all cases these sales would be just equivalent to what happens in ordinary activities. Now, as to the cost, I would not, I think when we think of the costs of those that relate to the proceeds, I think we have to have in mind that we are talking now all industries together. And not only reflect and reason on the extractive industries, because for the cost, I think you have, in my view, a necessary incremental cost approach to adopt, because in some testing activities, you consume directly raw materials, if nothing more, that should certainly not be capitalized as part of the asset. So net proceeds... approach below gross profit, I could be much more comfortable with, notwithstanding the fact that I thought that the testing and disclosure approach was a better cost-benefit route, considering that it applies industry-wide.
Okay, so I think we have a majority for a modified ED approach. Yes. Can I see who supports that?
11.
Okay. All right.
No, we don't need more. We don't need to ask the second question.
No. Okay. So, cryptocurrencies.
Okay. That's much easier. So, gentlemen, in July, the board asked the Interpretations Committee for its advice on holdings of cryptocurrencies and initial coin offerings or ICOs. And the committee discussed these matters at its meeting in September. The purpose of this paper is to summarise the feedback received from the committee and to ask the board whether it would like to add a project to its work plan to address these matters. The paper first concentrates on holdings of cryptocurrencies. So paragraphs 12 to 24 of our paper describe the committee's feedback on applying existing IFRS standards to holdings of cryptocurrencies. Paragraphs 25 to 33 describe the committee's feedback on the usefulness of information obtained by applying these requirements. And paragraphs 34 to 39 discuss the committee's advice about standard setting activities. In addition, paragraphs 44 to 60 of our paper repeat the information about the prevalence of holdings of cryptocurrencies that we presented to the board in July. We acknowledge the concerns of some committee members about the usefulness of information provided by existing IFRS standards about holdings of cryptocurrencies. However, we think the prevalence of such transactions is insufficient to support the board undertaking standard setting activity at this time. Instead, we recommend that the board continues to monitor developments in this area and we have set out the monitoring activities we propose to undertake in paragraph 69 of our paper. We also recommend asking the Interpretations Committee to publish an agenda decision clarifying the application of existing IFRS standards, including the relevant disclosure requirements. Appendix A outlines some standard-setting alternatives if the Board does not agree with our recommendation. So question one for the Board is on page 15 of our paper, and this asks whether you agree with our recommendation related to holdings of cryptocurrencies.
Okay. Anne?
I don't agree with the idea of an agenda decision outlining how the current standards would apply, because I think the answer that we get is not appropriate for cryptocurrencies. So I understand what you're saying about them not being very prevalent in IFRS reporting firms, but we go on record with saying this is how you do it under our current standards. I think that puts us in a really bad position for if it became more prevalent. And irrespective of that, it still puts us in a bad position, because I don't like the accounting we get when we apply the current standards to cryptocurrencies.
Well, I wouldn't support that we do nothing at all. Is that the first thing I would like to say? Because this is an emerging phenomenon, and we have evidence of divergence of practices, and we are not sure that the accounting practice that develops are transparent enough on a subject that does not necessarily only involves, in my view, necessary financial information that we must provide, but I think the management stewardship aspect is also very important. And I would like to support some very light standard setting activity. I don't think an agenda decision is enough. I don't think an agenda decision is enough because, in my view, it would normalize these assets very much and not recognize, not acknowledge the particular difficulties that they rise with, in fact, a lot of uncertainties about the possible developments that they may trigger. So my preference would be to ask the IFREC to develop an interpretation of IS 38, IS 2, and also IS 1, with the view of not only including what could be included in an agenda decision of how IS 38 applies, but beyond that, I would want to interpret the recognition criterion in IS 38 as being subject to it being an active market. I would want to subject also the measurement requirement for brokers in IS 2 to subject that measurement to an active market as well. I would want to have the materiality assessments be made on the basis of nature. And finally, I would want the minimum line items so that there is full transparency on the fact that the entity has started holding crypto assets in one way or another.
Sue? What do you recommend yourself to do?
I actually liked the staff's recommendation to not do anything beyond asking the committee to consider publishing an agenda decision, because I think that at least has the advantage of confirming that what the discussion at the committee was in terms of either going to 38 or to 2. It worried me a bit when we looked at the application today and some people are getting to the financial standards. And even though I agree that getting to 38 is not perfect, it at least does have the benefit that there's a sort of gating to getting to fair value, that you need to have an active market, which is better than if people are going to the IFRS 9 at the moment, because there is no gating, so they could go straight to fair value, because I am very concerned about what on earth fair value actually means in the absence of an active market, because unlike a level three financial instrument, there's no contractual cash flows to measure or anything like that. So I actually thought that at least the having an agenda decision would mean at least we know what everybody is doing. And I think as part of that, we could think more about some disclosures that might be helpful in terms of visibility, because at the moment that's a challenge. But I wouldn't go personally onto more standard setting beyond that.
I mean, one of the things about an agenda decision is we could potentially highlight the disclosure requirements that are already there, even, because I think that if you had material amounts of this stuff, whether it's an IS2 or an IS38, I think you should be disclosing something about it, even under the existing requirements.
Yep. Martin?
Yeah, man. I was really, when I saw this paper set of our sample of 26 entities, 18 account for this under 39 or 9, so the majority is not doing what we think they should do. But then but I personally think maybe 4 to 39 is better than to 38. And then to issue an agenda decision, I don't know if that is really helpful. That's why I'm a little bit with Anne, saying, okay, should we really do that? And I thought, I would say, okay, maybe if we really convince that it's not so prominent now, okay, that we should do nothing either, or I think we should do standard setting how to deal with it. But to address now a gender decision for things we are not so convinced that is the right accounting, I understand your argument.
I'm just worried what the fair value number is that they're using.
Yeah, but they can also come to that, I think, in with 38.
So really, they have to have an active market. You can only do it with an active market.
But my understanding is, okay, that, I don't know. But also, I would be concerned if somebody would also use a cost thing. Now, that is also not good information, right?
Just if it's helpful, I think that it's important to that maybe don't view or recommendation, I think, around an agenda decision as some sort of alternative to standard setting in a sense. What I think it's important in your discussion is we're asking you today whether you think, you know, you should do standard setting or not standard setting. And it's almost, if you decide not standard setting and only monitor, then there's almost a separate question that says, do you think there would be any benefit in asking the committee to consider an agenda decision that would tell people how to do existing requirements? So that's helpful. It's just your question is standard setting or no standard setting.
No,
just monitor.
Let's apply that standard.
Yeah. And I think we have even also in 39 and 9, if it's not an active market, we still have to come up with a fair value. And here's more difficult, I understand that. But what is an alternative? If we would develop a kind of standard, I think there would not any alternatives than fair value.
But the problem, Martin, for me, is that the committee agreed that reading our requirements today, you actually can't get to 39 or 9.
Yeah, but isn't that also many committee members said, okay, they are not happy if we go into 39 and
to apply the standards.
To push maybe the majority of people who maybe went to 39 into the direction of an accounting standard where all the committee members think, okay, this is not good accounting. I don't know if we should do that. So maybe we should be silent, or I think we should, that is my conclusion.
Personally, if I think that's the answer. If we think that's the right answer, we should do standard setting to get to that answer, rather than have people not read the words and decide that's
that is what I think. Either we should do standard setting or do nothing. But to drive people into a standard which we think is not the right answer, or I think is not the right answer, I don't know if that is good. Good thing.
It's a bad product that deserves bad accounting. Daryl?
Okay. I don't want to grow a beard.
I think we should do like central banks, be vigilant, do a lot of monitoring, and otherwise engage in masterful activity.
I think the way Sue expressed it is right. Is I think we either write a standard for this, or we insist on consistent accounting. But I don't think we can have inconsistent accounting. We have to fix inconsistent accounting one way or the other. I would have liked to have seen us do something here, but I understand the prevalence point, and I understand even in the context of those companies where it's prevalent, it's unlikely to be particularly material. So I'm comfortable to go with the route of no standard setting, but that tells me that we have to do something about the inconsistency that's in place. And I think we do have the opportunity, if we do something about the inconsistency, to remind people about the disclosure requirements that are already required in the standard in those circumstances where this is a material.
Mary?
I support not doing standard setting. Personally, I'm very easy to distract with new bright spangly objects, and cryptocurrencies and crypto assets are kind of things everybody's chatting about. But when the staff did the research in here, the level of prevalence they turned up is so low that I think it's hard to justify diverting resources to standard setting for this, given some of the other things that, you know, we have on our list of things that we'd like to do or complete. So on that basis, I say no standard setting at this time. And support that part of the staff recommendation. In terms of encouraging the committee to publish an agenda decision, my concern about that is not the push to reminder about the scope and applicability of IS 38, but rather I think normally when the reason for not taking something on is that it is not sufficiently prevalent to warrant standard setting, we don't typically comment about the application of our standards, you know, in the agenda decision. So I think we just want to think about whether we want to deviate there. I think the staff papers initially for the interpretation committee and then recapping, including the committee members' comments about the staff analysis, are on the public record in this paper. So I think.
But we're in a weird sort of no man's
land. No, I agree that it's not authoritative. It is a no man's land, but it's on the record. And I think if I were a reporting entity that had enough of this to matter, that my confidence in my accounting policy that was applying IS 39 or IFRS 9, I'd be getting pretty wobbly about that after somebody told me about these discussions. And, IS 38 may not be the perfect model, but I don't share Anne's level of concern about it, because especially for what we see as the actual level, in terms of impact on financial statements, it may not be the optimal model, but I don't think it's worth constructing the optimal model for something. And I think it permits fair value information if there is an active market. It requires cost plus impairment if there's not an active market. It requires disclosure by class of asset.
It uses OCR.
It's not ideal, but if it's as small as the research says, that's not, to me, a big problem. But then the and the disclosure point is not a bad one. The one thing I think we'd want to be careful in any communications. I agree with the staff analysis about cryptocurrencies appearing to satisfy the indefinite life criterion in IS 38. But I think we've also heard about some other types of crypto assets that maybe might not. And we have to be very clear about the distinction between currency and asset. Because some, if you're in essence buying access to a private portal or something with, you may be getting something that you use in your business and that is somehow consumed. So let's just be careful in our expression so it doesn't get read overly broadly. But I kind of want to do something about it because everybody's talking about it, but the evidence says it's not big enough for us to divert resources from other things we should be doing.
And I think as well, just cause I know Anne mentioned something about OCI, Craig and I had a conversation the other day and what we said was, well, IS 38 might not provide the most useful information, but it doesn't provide the least useful information either. That is useful information, both from a, it does allow the fair value model. It does restrict the use of that model to when there is an active market. Fair value decreases do go through the P&L. So whilst there is OCI and there's no recycling and there's various rules around the treatment of revaluation surplus, some of that that information could be considered useful. One of the disclosures as well is if you are using a revaluation model, then you must also disclose the value of those assets as if they had been measured under the cost basis. That there are, in our view, I think, some useful disclosure requirements and some useful information provided.
Zhang Wu.
Thank you. I agree with the step recommendation monitoring. I don't agree with that agenda decision proposal. The reason why I'm saying is, as in France, many other people saying, agenda decision might not be sufficient to resolve this issue. And also, our interpreters committee have discussed this issue already. So I guess, based on your excellent analysis of this old application of ISO 38, so I don't expect any additional knowledge from that agenda decision, in addition to the analysis in this paper. So that's the one thing. Another thing is some committee members suggested to amend ISO 38 to remove this cryptocurrency from the scope of its ISO 38. That will give us some kind of a legal support, kind of our support. If we just let them use other standards, as Martin said, now most companies are using not IAS 38. So it's kind of a dilemma for us. But I think agenda decision is not a good idea anyway. So if you would like to do something more in addition to monitoring, we need to amend the scope of IAS 38.
Tom?
Yeah, I'm kind of back where Anne started. But first of all, let me say I'm all for monitoring, like Chung Wu said, and I actually think the steps you said in terms of what you would monitor are good, so that would be good. I think there are a couple of options doing standard setting. If we are monitoring, I was okay with actually leaving what the discussion was and being silent subsequently. I completely agree with Anne that putting out something that's going to say, "Let's use this poor accounting because we'll eliminate diversification," and have everybody do not very good accounting. I just don't like that. And, when I look back, and again, the earlier discussions, the national standard setters who have looked at and written reports, they all come down to fair value. We did the world standard setters and went to the conceptual framework. Everybody came down to fair value. So that there seems to be a general sense that fair value through profit or loss is probably the best solution. And so some entities, a majority of them, however they're getting there, whether they're getting there through IAS 8 or whether they're just, who knows, but they're trying to get to, I think, the better accounting, and I'm not keen on saying don't go to the good accounting, but converge around this not so good accounting. And then I think it's going to be very hard to undo it if we leave that out there for a long time. So I'm okay with either being silent, or if we want to do some standard setting, that's fine too. I'm not keen on doing the agenda decision that will put IAS 38 out there as a solution.
Amaro?
Thanks. Much has been said already in the same line that I would like to mention. I think I share Mary's view on this and a little bit of concern about the agenda decision. So I have I agree with the first part of the question, continue to monitor. I am concerned about the agenda decision. But my question is, since this issue has been brought to the committee has to issue something, right?
I said we're in no man's land at the moment.
So first of all, let's clarify. So the reason the committee discussed it actually was because the board asked the committee to discuss it. And specifically, because specifically you asked the committee what for their views on the existing accounting. But maybe there's just, only if it's helpful to clarify the agenda decision, by the way. Asking the committee to consider agenda decision is not standard setting. It's not a solution if you think standard setting is needed. Yes. All it would do is set out what we think the accounting is based on existing requirements. That's all it would do.
Yeah, I would be more cautious about agenda decisions. And I think agenda decisions, as we envisage, I expect it to be somewhat followed as best practices. So my question why, my question, if the committee has to issue because we ask it then, so if they don't have, I feel even more comfortable. I think we are not, especially consider the research done by the staff and the fact that we didn't go through a detailed process of assessing the best accounting for this. We are hearing different perspectives. I would prefer not issue an agenda decision at this stage, continue monitoring, and if we do believe it's necessary, we go through a process and more detailed assessment of the accounting we have at the moment and what would be the best alternative.
Well, I suggested an interpretation, and I see a number of merits. One being that it would be mandatory. So if we are serious about wanting to have consistent accounting practices, we should not solely rely on an agenda decision that may or may not be enforced. And I would want, you know, to just think a minute about the difference there is in our work and our strength, our resources, between an agenda decision and interpretation. Same group doing it, and you have some due process, so you have some comment letters to analyze. So basically, it's in the balloting process that you see the difference in process. And the interpretation, is one of our tools.
But just going back to Petrina's point, I mean, to be clear, an interpretation is standard setting.
Yeah.
You're still changing, you know, it's standard setting.
It's standard setting, yeah. I standard setting, but why wouldn't we? I mean, we're standard setters, so what is so strange that we would?
And I think we could. It's only to say in terms of staff resources, I can only tell you, having obviously gone through various bits of standard setting that we do, as even very narrow scope standard setting, even annual improvements, compared to issuing an agenda decision, I can just tell you the amount of time and resource it takes around doing even very narrow scope standard setting. It does involve considerably, noticeably more time and resource than going through the process of finalising an agenda decision.
Well, I think we're stretching this agenda decision tool beyond what it's meant for. And it's not mandatory. Or we should make them mandatory, but, I mean...
Tak?
Thank you. Actually, ASBJ has issued accounting standard for encrypted currency. And in that standard, they said encrypted currency is kind of independent asset and they're not requiring to categorize any other assets and measure fair value through profit or loss. It was possible, but only because FSA of Japan has defined what's the encrypted currency is all about. And based on that definition, ASBJ decided if you have this defined asset, then go to this accounting treatment. It was only possible because, you know, FSA has defined what the encrypted currency asset is. It cannot be the case for ISB because, as Mary pointed out, there is not much, you know, transactions, and nobody has defined what's the asset we should treat. We could define by ourselves, but because there are a variety of transactions, I don't think it's too early. I think it's too early to define by ourselves and find out the scope of the project. So therefore, as Amaro said, I think we need to monitor the transaction now and do nothing. And we could provide some agenda decision, but as Amaro pointed out, danger of agenda decision is we may guide some direction. So just not guiding anything, just monitoring for a while. But instead, if you think it's really prevailing, then we should be ready to do the quick action.
I find this discussion quite surreal, I have to say. So, all that an agenda decision does is said we don't think we need to do standard setting, and it would be saying these are what the current words say. Whether or not we do an agenda decision, the committee has already read the words, and all of the committee members, I think, from memory, have already said out loud, in public, to the world, and our staff agrees, that reading our scope requirements faithfully in these standards at the moment, you either get to 38 or 2. Mm. By not issuing an agenda decision, that doesn't change what the requirements in our book are. And if we seriously think that by not issuing an agenda decision, we're saying, don't worry about our requirements, you don't have to follow them. I mean, is that really what we're saying to the world? And if the reason why you don't want to issue an agenda decision is because you don't like the answer, we have to change the standards, guys. Mm. We can't just say ignore the standards and do what you like. I mean, that's not how this organisation works. These are requirements. These are requirements, and the scope requirements get you to 38 or 2. Our staff say that, the committee says that, and nobody's issued an argument that I've heard disagreeing with that. But you're saying if we don't write it down on paper, we can pretend that's not the answer. Really? I mean, if we want to change requirements, that's fine. I'm not going to stop it. I'd rather do work and say, staff, let's do some work if we don't want people to go to 38. And I'd much rather support that than say, just do what you feel is right in your hearts. We don't mind. Because, and if people have got active markets and they're coming up with fair value, that's great. I think that's fine. But we had a good discussion at the Interpretations Committee about what the concept of a fair value even is. If you've got a cryptocurrency and there's no active market, how do you value that thing? And if we've got no guidance, no requirements, and we're saying if you feel like it, go to IFRS 9, we've got no idea what people are doing.
Okay. Quick, and then we come to the decision. Jen Chow?
Just quick. First of all, I agree with we continue to monitor the development of the crypto currency because currently there are a lot of different kinds of cryptocurrencies, and also it's up to different jurisdictions, regulator, legal requirements, something like that. So I think it's a still very early age to go to directly go to standard setting stage. I think it, and the second with regards to agenda decision, it seems that originally I would like to ask question, what's the applicable existing IFI standard in mind? But currently it seems that we're going to, you know, say that it actually it's IS 37 or 38. Yeah, sorry, 38.
Eight.
Yeah, so but 38, I think fair value, it's no problem. And the changes of fair value will go to OCI. Maybe there are some problem because for those companies, as Martin said, they already accounted those, you know, cryptocurrency at fair value through P&L. It will be a big change for them. And secondly, for some companies, actually, currently they are using cost model under IAS 38. So whether that objective could be achieved or whether they can using maybe IAS 2 or other, you know, accounting treatment, they could be allowed. So I'm thinking about how to draft our agenda decision, how to clarify those things, not result in that finally, the company actually cannot provide useful information, just comply our existing standard, but cannot provide useful information, or even significantly lost some useful information comparing currently what they are doing at this moment. So, yeah.
Okay, Daryl, and then we vote.
I just want to make one comment if it's helpful. in the context of existing requirements, I know we're all immediately going to 38 and making comments. We have to remember, if you get caught by two first, you get caught by two. And at least I think, and we haven't been able to do get intelligence around this around, but first of all, of, and I say, only the 37 IFRS reporters that we know exist, by the way, and this is most of those 25 in Canada. 25 in Canada looks big, but Tom, you'll confirm, we heard from our Canadian Interpretation Committee member that there are more than 3,000 listed companies in Canada. So just to put the prevalence in context, 25 out of more than 3,000 in that jurisdiction. Even then, first and foremost, according to our existing requirements, is if any of those companies are holding this, are holding it for sale in the ordinary course of their business, which I think at least some could probably meet, they would apply IS2 and they potentially, if they're considered a broker trader, could use fair value through P&L for that. So even of the numbers we've identified, not even all of those, I think, would end up in IS38 accounting. So it's just to put this in context. We're all feeling very upset about 38 accounting, but all we know is it's definitely less than 37 IFRS reporters today that potentially will end up in that accounting.
Okay. Daryl?
So just to emphasise that I think I agreed with most of what Sue just said. I think to just emphasise again that my understanding is that this horse has bolted. People are already starting to think about how they need to change their accounting, assuming we do nothing. And thirdly, to say I think this is exactly what an agenda decision is about. The standard we think is clear. The vast majority of the IFRA committee seems to think that the standard is clear. There is diversity in practice, and we can get rid of that diversity in practice by applying the clear standard.
Furthermore, the committee's had a public discussion about on public papers. I think if we decide not to do standard setting, if we just leave it open, there will be considerable confusion about what's...
I think what's being created now is that those people who follow what the committee does will have already started to think about how they're going to change. Those who don't. So we've introduced more diversity just by having the conversation. Yeah. So now we need to finish it.
Exactly. Okay. Well, so everybody's in favour of monitoring. Then the question is, do we ask the committee to consider publishing an agenda decision? Who is supporting of this?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7.
Seven. Double exercising my... what is
testing
vote. Yeah. All right. Question two.
Yes, the second section of our paper talks about initial coin offerings or ICOs. So the feedback from the committee on the application of existing standards to ICOs is summarised in paragraphs 74 to 78. And information about the prevalence of ICO transactions is in paragraphs 79 to 84. And we think this information indicates that ICOs are not common at this time. Accordingly, we recommend that the board consider ICOs as part of its proposed monitoring activities. So question two for the board is on page 17 of our paper and asks whether the board agrees with this recommendation.
Do we agree with this recommendation?
Daryl? So I don't think we can come up with a different answer. Yes, I absolutely agree with the recommendation. And I'm very nervous to even bring this up. I want to put down a little bit of a marker because I think if the primary object or the primary reason for our logic here is prevalence, and if we were to conclude that it is more prevalent among smaller companies that apply IFRS for SMEs, I think we need to at least be asking ourselves the question whether that would suggest that we must look at this in that context. Now, that's for a discussion much further down the line, but I think it is just something that I want to put on the table.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's in listed companies, so they wouldn't be eligible for the SME standard.
No. What I'm saying is we don't know whether SMEs have a greater prevalence of cash offerings, crowdfunding, and holding the actual coins.
Support staff recommendation.
14.
On transport. And we've got a very long paper.
Following on our vote for an agenda decision, I would like to highlight two things. First of all, I would like the agenda decision to also emphasize the recognition criteria in ISO 38 and emphasize how it should be applied. And I would also highlight, following what Suze said, that when you read just ISO 2 the way it is, you allow brokers to go to fair value less cost to sales without any condition as to it being an active market. And this is a fair value through P&L. And I'm just, I mean, the decision is made, but wanted to emphasize that you also have, if you have a concern that what is fair value when there is no active market, you probably have something to say in your agenda decision about this matter.
Okay. Next issue, yes. Owner's contracts.
Yes, again, 12E. And this is related to owner's contracts, cost of fulfilling the contract. So comments received on the pre-ballot draft of the ED owner's contracts, cost of fulfilling a contract, highlighted that the proposals did not address early application. This agenda paper asked the board whether it agrees with our recommendation to permit early application of the amendments.
Tom, for voting.
Proofly, we can write a board paper on two pages.